I'm going to start with my panelists introducing themselves. Now, we will do the introductions a little bit different because I'm familiar with two of the four panelists, and my job is to be quiet. As long as I am quiet, then we're all right. Okay.
Shall I begin?
No. You're going to be second.
Very
the reason
good.
You're going to be second is because I have already set someone up.
All right. Tim. Shall I go? Okay. Good morning.
Tim is going to tell you about music and science fiction.
Yeah.
The reason for that is because he is a teacher, but he's also very heavily into the music. Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you.
And then you come back over here, and then we'll get to it in the middle. Thank you. Now I can sit down and shut
we
up.
Didn't even practice that. I'm Tim Griffin. I was an elementary, full-time elementary teacher in Los Angeles for about 20 years, and at the same time was writing and performing and recording educational music for kids on the side. Now what I'm doing, as of about a year ago, I'm running a small educational nonprofit dedicated to teaching science and other subjects through music. So for grades K to 8, we have a lot of specific grade level content and songs, mostly that I've written, plus there are a few people who have very graciously allowed me to use their music on my site. I got a couple of CDs down in the dealer's room, but the main thing is the music is all free on my website. It's the streaming audio is free for now, and once we get it retooled, we're going to have free downloads as well. The lyrics are there along with notes for how to incorporate it into curriculum. Mostly because we haven't yet adopted Common Core standards for science, I'm working with California standards. But generally, there's not that much difference from state to state in terms of you know what we're doing in fourth grade, what we're doing in fifth grade. So my intent is to create a free online resource, and I do travel around and perform at schools. So that's kind of my story.
Okay.
I'm Violet Milan, and I possibly am, again, the only Canadian on the panel.
I hope so.
So I
like Canadians.
Once or twice you may find that I'm going to ask for clarification on certain points, because it will be clear to me from what's being said that we do things slightly differently in mm-hmm. Canada. So I'll ask you to bear with me on that. My academic background, I have a PhD in 18th century English literature, and while I have taught at the public school level, most of my teaching experience has been at the university level and as a private tutor. But I have a great interest in education, obviously, having spent 27 years of my life in a classroom of one kind or another, on one side of the desk or the other. And I also have a great belief that if we don't start people reading early, we're not going to get them reading late. And as I am now a fantasy novelist, I have a vested interest in making sure that people are reading. By the way, Tim, you've got a great name for a fantasy novelist. So, maybe you should, Tim Griffin? Excellent. I think you should think about this.
Come on in. Come on here where some of the bait is out. Please.
People keep sending us little griffins, thinking they'll see a griffin in the dealer's room and
yeah.
give it to us. And they're sure every time they're the first person to
oh,
do that.
Oh, whoever thought of that. Exactly. Yeah.
Go ahead. You get to choose between the two.
Okay.
wow.
Farthest.
All right, I'm Chris Morell. I have a master's degree in English literature, and I teach a science fiction class for seniors at the high school level, so I'm a high school English teacher. I've been doing that for the last 8 years. When I started that program, the program was just one section of English, and I wasn't doing very well, so I took over, I scrapped the program, redid the reading list, and now we have 5 sections of science fiction at the school, so it's become very popular, and I'm teaching most of them. What else? Let's see. I also write science fiction. I've gotten some nice rejection letters, but I haven't published anything yet. And that's about it for me.
Okay. My name's Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University. I teach courses going into my 10th year there, actually. I teach courses in fantasy, science fiction, creative writing, and others. And I actually started by teaching in an inner-city high school, so I had kind of movement from that into ultimately an urban university. Also, I've been there, as I say, since about 2003. I'm also an author. My first novel came out a couple of years back. Next two are being shopped as we speak. And I have some short stories, one that just came out in an anthology called When the Villain Comes Home, which just came out this month. And let's see, I'm co-editing an anthology in speculative fiction and politics with many authors who are here. And lastly, I do a co-running podcast with Brad Bollier, who's also a speculative fiction author, called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, which has been running now for about a year and a half, and which interviews and talks about the work of authors, editors, agents, and even artists from the field of speculative fiction, people like Brent Weeks and Pat Rothfuss and Kiz Johnson and Nora Jemison and Jim Kelly and most recently Saladin Ahmed. And if you're interested, and also Betsy Wolheim, and if you're interested in that, you can find out more about that at speculatesf.com.
Okay, any questions from the audience at this time? A quiet audience? We don't have quiet audiences. We have people who talk, who interrupt me all the time because I need to be interrupted. My history, back to my history. When I first met Dave Brin, and he may show up, Dave Brin wants to come in and talk to you about the Speakers Bureau. How many of you have ever heard about science fiction and their Speakers Bureau? Okay. I should now call on her and have her tell me all about it.
I don't know enough about it to tell you all about it.
There's a guy named Jim Gunn, who will be at the next Worldcon. Jim is, of course, one of the masters of science fiction. His brother was a doctor. His brother had money, and he set up an organization at KU, Kansas University, or University of Kansas?
Kansas University.
Yeah, I can never keep them straight.
The other one's K-State.
But anyhow, it has to do with the Center for Science Fiction. One of the best resources you can ever have. They have complete information on if you want to set up a science fiction course, how do you talk to people to set it up so you can teach science fiction. They have samples of just about everything. I lose track because I haven't been in there this week. One of the things that they have is a subculture called About Science Fiction. Normally, what we've been doing in the past is About Science Fiction and RFF have gotten together and put together these nice little get-togethers at Worldcons. We didn't this year. Why? About Science Fiction, to me, is more academic. I am more grassroots. You know, do they ever meet? So anyhow, Dave, if he shows up, will want to talk to you about Speakers Bureau. If you go into the deep bowels of About Science Fiction, you will find that you can get somebody to come and talk to you about science fiction. Some of them, like Dave, charge an arm and a leg. Others, like me, would be free. But you find them by zip code, generally. So you know those who are closest to you, and they will tell you exactly. They expect a cookie and a donut and a cup of coffee, or they expect $1,000 to come to your facility. Great, great group. Dave wants more people to use it. As you know, Mr. Brin just came out with a book. And it's his first book in 8 years. How did he go for 8 years without writing? He is a consultant to the government. He likes to do television. He likes to do speaking. He does all of these things, and he does a great job at it. Okay. Any other comments? Any other questions? Something new? We are going to start now with the last person, and Tell us a little bit more about your programs, what you do, and how you do things.
Okay. Let's see. So I have taught, and it's been over the last 10 years on the university level, as I said. I started by teaching courses in creative writing and one sort of joint fantasy science fiction course where I did both. And I did that for some years until the last couple of years where I was finally able to prevail on the university to split them. So I can do science fiction in the fall and fantasy in the spring, which is much better because I get the chance to teach many more works than would otherwise be the case. And one of the things that that's done is also start growing a culture, let's say, within the university of students and hopefully professors who are interested in science fiction and fantasy more broadly. So I'm not just dealing with, you know, the couple of hardcore Doctor Who fans and then a bunch of people who are sort of generically interested, kind of, but people who have heard about the class from other, you know, classmates or roommates or people that are ahead of them slightly in the program or behind them and are interested in taking these courses. The interesting thing has been the way in which my connections in this community have addressed both the creative courses and the fantasy and science fiction courses. I have an article coming out in the CIFWA Bulletin at the end of the year about this subject, about the crossing between academic and creative lives. And I've been able to have speakers come in and speak to both of my classes. So I've had Brandon Sanderson come in and speak, come in by which I mean via Skype, but you know, speak to my class in fantasy because I taught his book, The Ally of Law, in the spring. That was a huge thrill for my students and was largely unprompted. I interviewed him on Speculate and he happened to say, you know, if you ever teach a book of mine, I'd be happy to do a video chat. And I said, yes, please, and managed to get him in. I've also met people that have been not necessarily in literature specifically, but are in our field more generally. So Norman Cates, who works at Weta Digital and is actually here at Worldcon, I met him at Worldcon in Reno last year and got him to, again, do a Skype in at some ungodly hour from New Zealand to talk to my creative writing course about the creative process. Because one of the things I want to do is establish this idea of what creative writing is in general in terms of creative thinking before we actually get down to workshopping and, you know, all the standard stuff that people generally do in those creative courses. That, again, was a big thrill for the students, and it really helped give them this sense that there's a world outside the classroom, which I think is something that we'll probably talk about here. One of the big benefits of teaching science fiction or fantasy in any class that you're going to do is that it gives you a chance to connect with your students on a level outside the room in which you're sitting. Because the reality is that most of the students that you run into at this point will have, even if they don't realize it, some tangential interest in fantastical literature or fantastical culture. You'll have a hard time, I think, by the time you see many of your students, if you're teaching in high school, not finding one who hasn't seen The Dark Knight Rises, for example, or who hasn't read something of the Harry Potter books, or even seen the movie, or who isn't excited about the new Star Trek movie coming out, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So it seems to me that rather than pretending, you know, those students don't exist, as a lot of high school and college classrooms do, it's important to bring them in as many contexts as possible. And so that's one of the things that I try to do in the courses that I teach on both creative writing and, you know, more fantasy and science fiction literature, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions? Everyone knows all the answers? Good. Sit at one of the places that have some debate out. Yeah. If you can.
You can tell
we're talking about something workshop and nobody's front. We're very, very, very important.
Yeah, but you notice the front seat is far in that side.
Right. I thought it was.
Well, I've got a question, actually, for all of you, if we can. How many of you are teachers in the field, teach classes, or are interested in learning about teaching classes of this kind? Do you have a lot of teachers? Some. I saw some. Well, maybe. Okay. Just so we have an idea.
Maybe I'm not.
Yeah, maybe I should be.
I'm interested in teaching in that field, but okay. I don't know if I ever will.
May I interject? Okay. Anyone here in elementary education?
Pardon?
Anyone here in elementary? Cool. Good. Middle school? High school? No. College?
Yeah. Okay.
My interest is finding out how you get teachers interested in teaching in the first place before you get to how they do it.
Now you're in the hardest question. You've already asked it.
Yeah.
go to About Science Fiction, and in there there's how to get your district and your school board interested in offering classes in science fiction.
first chapter of the side book, kind of science fiction, if you want to be more academic and you want to go into the history and start with Frankenstein and go up to whoever, Hunger Games, wherever you want to go, that about science fiction is a really good resource for a lot of that kind of
stuff. Is it a website or a book?
It's a website.
About the science fiction?
About science fiction, just one word. About SF. I'm sorry. I need to give you the correct one. Unfortunately, it's not in your bait in the stuff you've got. But they have a lot of things that can help you in there. The problem you're going to run into is that we have a lot of closet science fiction fans. If you're academic, a lot of times you don't want to admit that you even know what science fiction is about. Mm-hmm. We have down in a little place called Utah County. In Utah, we have two universities. One of them everyone knows, that's BYU. The one that is a little bit larger is one that just started a couple of years ago. It was a community college, went up to Becker College, went all the way up until the university. Reading for the Future, which is my bellowing. I got a call, wanted to know, how do you set up a class? She wanted to set up a class. She didn't know what to set it up. Was it going to be fantasy or was it going to be science fiction? She decided to go with science fiction. And then later on, maybe add in the fantasy. She had overflowing classrooms. She had more students than any other first year class there. Why? Kids want to read it. I don't care about teachers, you know. We can let people be the closet science fiction reader, never want to admit that they know what it is. Another way is you could be James Van Pelt. I'm going back to your creative writing. Mm-hmm. How many of you would love to be invisible? Raise your hand. Yeah. You enjoy being naked, blind, having people jab you with pencils in the hallway at school.
Sounds like my middle school experience.
To think about what is the advantages and disadvantages.
We had that dream last night.
Mm-hmm.
next time you're in with your peer group in the thing, ask them a question like that and get them talking about science fiction. Yes.
This might be more for Professor Wilson and Mr. Burrell. I teach at a community college.
Okay.
I have gone through the work of getting approval to teach a science fiction course.
Okay.
Now I am building the course. And so I'm trying to, and we run in quarters, so I imagine I have 11 weeks, 22 meetings, 44 hours of contact time. And so I'm trying to think about a mixture of articles, short stories, perhaps not too many novels, mm-hmm. but I would love to know what your syllabi both look like and what works, what have been some very successful texts and readings for you, and what really draws and engages students.
Okay.
Good question. So you want to take one lead off?
I can talk specifically about my class. I might as well just run through my my course syllabus for you, I guess. That's the idea. In my class, the goal really is to get the kids interested in reading. You know, at the senior level, it's kind of surprising. Sometimes you get a lot of kids that aren't interested in reading,
sure.
which is a shock to me sometimes. So my goal with science fiction, it being this really engaging kind of literature, is to get them interested. So some of the texts that I use, I should just give you all of them. We start with Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. That for them is really an interesting read. It's engaging. It's really evocative. A lot of good imagery, good character. That really gets them started really well. Then we jump into Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein. That's a little more of a difficult work, but I would think at the community college level that would work just fine. It works well for seniors. Most of them like it. Then we read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep,
yep.
which turned into Blade Runner. Again, another challenging work, but at the senior level they do fine with that. I show them Blade Runner as well. And they get a little confused with Blade Runner, but
they're not alone.
Like we all do, yeah.
Right.
I also use Michael Crichton's Sphere, which is another easy read, but we do a lot of psychoanalytic theory with that book, so there's some deep discussion that we can do with that novel. And then at the end of the year, I do either I Am Legend by Richard Matheson, which is an old horror/sci-fi novel, And sometimes I'll teach War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, and that's good too. There are other books. We have another teacher in the district that's teaching a sci-fi course as well, and she does some of the work that I do. She also does Dune, which I've always been kind of surprised at. She says it goes well. I'm surprised because it's 500 pages and really deep and really rich. Mm-hmm. I would think that the kids would be kind of put off by that. She does Foundation as well by Isaac Asimov. That probably works pretty well. I have a colleague that does Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I don't think that's a good one to do because it's kind of silly and I don't think you could write on it. I have a colleague that does Hunger Games. I think at the senior level, that's kind of a silly choice. But, you know, it's kind of up to the individual. So those are some of the works that I do. I think that those are good.
At an earlier panel, that both David and I were on the panel, was actually about teaching the Hunger Games.
Was it?
And one of the issues that came up was if not should you or if you should teach it, because we were all in agreement that you easily could.
One person was not in.
Well, she said afterwards that she was in agreement, but she was doing the devil's advocate. One of us had to not agree with all the rest, otherwise we would have just been sitting here going, yes, indeed. Her objection actually was, and I think this was her legitimate objection, she wasn't pretending, was that she felt it wasn't challenging enough as a literary work.
Right.
But I think the consensus among the rest of us was, well, no one was expecting it to be taught at the university level or even at the senior high school level.
Right.
We would have recommended it as something as a freshman, an entry-level reading rather than a senior level reading.
Yeah.
So I because you mentioned the Hunger Games, mm-hmm. you were saying like, well, you know, you weren't too sure about it. I thought like it's definitely what I would have thought of as a grade seven, grade eight.
Sure.
Rather than a grade 12.
It's a good gateway drug into science fiction, I think.
That's exactly what I called it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I teach a number of, there are some similar texts and some crossover. My course, remember, is being taught to largely juniors and seniors with a couple of college sophomores sprinkled in, but it tends to be more upperclassmen. But it is an introductory course, and it's designed to give them roughly a kind of chronological sweep of the field, and I'm always annoyed at myself when I'm kind of looking back at it saying, how do I, this is the problem every teacher and professor has, right? How do I encompass the field? It's like that old joke about history courses that you never get past Vietnam, And so the 1975 roughly onwards has gotten, less and less treatment because you've got so much stuff you have to cover. In my case, for my science fiction course, I lead off with Frankenstein. I move on to, and again, these are going to, you'll know all of these, and these are all relatively seminal works. The Time Machine, Fahrenheit 451, iRobot. I do a section on a lot of the old Star Trek episodes, in large part because the old Star Trek is obviously not only foundational for our field, it's also foundational for a lot of the Star Trek that follows. So it gives them a sense of like how, they went from point A to point B. And I will sometimes show in contradistinction to that, clips from the new Star Trek movie to give them a sense of how things changed rather radically, but also how the spirit that animates that movie is similar, I think, to the spirit that animated the original. I happen to be a fan of the movie because I think it caught a lot of what was great about the original series, and more importantly, my students agree. So that's helpful because it gets them on my side. Then we move on to Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep also, and I also use parts of Blade Runner to kind of, work in with that. Then we go into Ender's Game, which is almost always the most popular text of the course. And it's an interesting thing for me because as, a professor and a writer in the field, I was never that wild about that book, I have to be honest. Mm-hmm. My students are always wild about the book, so there's something there that I kind of continually have to look into and see why it has that impact. I think it has something to do with the interesting plot. I think it has a lot to do with the way that Card represents Ender. I think a lot of my students either feel bad for or identify directly with him. It is very difficult to get them to criticize Ender, even when he does some stuff that, is problematic, obviously. killing people, you know, because they say, well, but you have to understand, he was under so much pressure, which are all reasonable arguments, but it's interesting how much they identify with him. Mm-hmm. And then the last book that I do in that course is an open text, and I've moved back and forth on what to do with this. One of the big limitations of this list, and by the way, I should say, the reason I mostly teach novels is because it's a once-a-week course, and it just sort of tracks better for me than to do lots of short stories. But that last text has been difficult. I have had, at various times, James Patrick Kelly's Burn in there. I've tried Stanislaw Lem, Tales of Perks the Pilot. That didn't go over well, by the way. I have tried Gibson's Neuromancer earlier on, which also didn't work that well, and I think it's because that book is so dense for a lot of them that it doesn't... I thought when I taught it, it's the Matrix, you know? I mean, how could you possibly... They didn't really kind of... There was a lot of sort of almost hand-holding, I think, which is my least favorite type of teaching. So that didn't work out particularly well. So that last text is always in flux, and that's actually okay because the first part of the semester I'm able to assess, you know, where they are, and as we're going through it, it gives me a sense of what I can work with at the end. I may try Nnedi Okorafor's Who Fears Death there this time, I don't know. I'm kind of still processing in my head what that final text of the semester is going to be. But the point here, I think, is that when you're sort of setting up how you want the kind of semester to play out, and how you want, you know, or in your case, quarter to play out, there's two principles that I have learned I think are really important. One, don't overload your students. I made that mistake early on where I tried to give them too many works, and I tried to say, you know, I mean, we've got a whole field to cover, you know? I mean, and the reaction that I get if I do too much is that they just sort of shut down midway. And, you know, we'll get through it, but it won't be as enjoyable to them, and they won't be as sort of fired up to continue reading it, because you're right, one of the things that I'm doing is not necessarily getting them to read, but at least getting them to really like science fiction and fantasy going forward. So I want to make sure that they don't shut down. So not overloading them, taking time with your students. And then the second thing is not to make the assumptions that you have about given texts or works the same assumptions that they will automatically have. Because students will come in with very different expectations of books, texts, short stories, whatever the case may be, than you will have. And so you may think this is going to work perfectly because when I was, you know, an undergraduate, I thought this was awesome. Well, you know, first of all, you were an undergraduate long before they were. And secondly, your take as a professor in this field is going, you know, or as a teacher in this field is going to be vastly different from students who may be generally interested but aren't, shock and horror, going to go on to teach, you know? So I think one of the things you have to think about then is making sure that you work with what the students are reacting to. Kind of go with the flow, I guess is what I would say a little bit. And that's especially important when you're trying to, maybe not proselytize, but when you're trying to give them a sense of how fascinating these forms of literature can be. One last thing that I'll say is that there is a huge collection edited by a guy named Lee Grossman from the University of Connecticut. And the name escapes me, I'm sorry to say, but it is a massive collection of largely short stories, some novellas, that was published, and I think last year, I want to say, only, and is the largest collection ever put together, and may be useful in environments where you're meeting, let's say, three times a week, or where you know, the novel doesn't track as well, or if you're dealing with students that don't respond to novels, you know, particularly well, and you want to give them some short story options as well. That may be the case for you, too, I don't know. If that's the case, this is a book which is not expensive, and which is really a staggering, I mean, he did an incredible amount of work to put this together, and there's a lot of great work from all, you know, different areas. It's a very diverse collection as well. I don't remember the name of it, I'm sorry, but it's University of Connecticut, and the guy's name is L-E-I-G-H Grossman. And so I recommend that too if you're looking for an alternate collection.
Thank you very much.
Greg, can I ask a question? This is a kind of personal field of inquiry of my own. And you were mentioning your reaction to Ender's Game in comparison to that of the students.
Yeah.
Now, when you first read it, can I ask you what age or what stage in your SF reading you were at when you first read it yourself?
Yeah, it's a good question. Pretty late. I'd say I was probably a junior or senior in college, I would think. Mm-hmm. I didn't read it earlier than that. Yeah, I think I was a senior in college.
Yeah, yeah. Because that matches my own experience.
Okay.
And what I call this the window effect. There is a time for you to read something
where
it will shock and astonish you.
Yeah.
And it will be, it will have the effect of an epiphany.
Yeah.
And if you read it before you're ready, before the window opens, you won't have that. And if you read it after the window's closed, you won't have it.
Yep.
So that, for me, that's exactly what happened with Ender's Game.
Yeah.
I could see how much I would have enjoyed it at a different time in my life.
That's a good point. And actually, Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash had a similar effect for me. When I first read that, I was blown away by it. And when you read it later, it doesn't date as well. But boy, when I read it, I was just exhilarated, like one of those, you feel dizzy, you know, when you close it. And yeah, I think it was a similar thing. I was at that time when it worked. Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, one thing about Ender's Game in particular is the general guideline, and this is certain, this may be more of an issue for middle school and elementary school, when you're trying to figure out what age a book is appropriate for, the general guideline is you look at how old the protagonist is. And on that basis, you know, in the elementary school, you remember those Scholastic book catalogs that you get each month, you know, the little things you hand out to the kids? Mm-hmm. They consistently put Ender's Game at least once a year in the Arrow level catalog, which is grades 5 and 6. And, I love it when kids read, but I would never recommend it for kids that age. And my son is 11 years old, and there's no way he's ready for that book.
Yeah.
And he's a solid reader, too.
Yeah.
Okay, any more
freshmen?
Well, any more comments?
Yeah. I believe that.
Yeah, okay. It's a great book.
We'll get from you, and then we'll go over to the lady here, and then we'll go over here, and then we'll go there, and then we'll come back to me. Okay, let's go.
Who's first?
The gentleman. Oh, I was just saying, Ender's Game, we've taught Ender's Game. I teach in a public high school just a few minutes north of here. We've used Ender's Game with freshmen and sophomore students, and it has been wonderfully successful.
Yep.
As has Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
We've started this year with the Adoration of Jenna Fox by Mary Pearson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first year we've done it, and so far so good, with a strong SF piece by a woman with a female protagonist.
Yep.
And so far so good. School's 10 days old. So.
Which, by the way, I want to say something to that. Diversity of author list is something that everyone struggles with, too, especially in science fiction. Because if I'm going to give them the so-called seminal list, it's hard to do it without it tracing really white and male. Yeah. And, so I lead off, thankfully, with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I agree worked very well with my students, too. I wasn't sure if they were going to deal with they loved it. But that's always a concern for me, is trying to make sure I keep that in the back of my mind while still doing some reasonable justice to the shape of the field. Like, can I ignore the time machine? I don't think so. But obviously, white male. So you're right that the diversity of the list is something we have to keep in the back of our mind all the time. So I'm glad that Mary Pearson thinks it up.
Whereas I've tried Left Hand of Darkness with high school seniors, and they turn into Linda Blair with the head spinning. Not going to fly, Orville.
Okay, it's your turn.
Hi, my name is Linda Williams. I'm a member of the RFF for a long time. Yes,
I cut my hair. Without my glasses. She also has some great writings.
Yes,
and she's also Canadian.
A Canadian, yes. Canadian woman, yeah. On the, I write a 10-novel series called The Oakle Rail Saga. I'm on book 7. I wrote it for adults originally, and Intellectual Mind Candy is what I call it. It's both, if its genre is space opera. It's basically me through 2 master's degrees trying to figure out how to justify some of my teenage fantasies, I think, in some ways. But in the process, I think I have worked in quite a lot of sociological philosophy. Most of the science is from my early geeky science days. But I have a growing readership and participation group of younger readers. So I'm going with both at the moment. And I think what I want to contribute to the conversation about what you might put in your curriculum is an invitation. I'm planning to party on my blog for the next year and a half, and then I'm going to drop down dead tired. Because I do this part-time. I do this outside of a full-time job, and I teach part-time in another field. So I'm looking to engage people who are interested in commenting on science fiction and also engaging. My stories grew out of literally play. I never stopped playing as a kid. And my first novel has a co-author. I am also the editor of a 12-novel series now of legacy works set in my universe, in which I currently have two male adults writing. One is a professional fencer who wants to write about physics, and the other is a professional physicist who wants to write about fencing, which is kind of confusing, and they won't talk to each other, but,
No, the world would end, right? I mean, matter, antimatter, no.
But you also know Chrissia, who is a teenager who wrote two novellas in my universe, and I have a series of anthologies, and I now have a couple of young people who are playing reporter for me on Reality Skimming, and so I'd like to get the names of all of you who are interested in being interviewed for Reality Skimming, where we talk about optimistic sci-fi, ethics in science fiction, and just about anything else anybody wants to. And I also pour out lots of Oklahoma Universe stuff. So if anybody has got classes they're teaching and they would like to engage with me or some of my collaborators, I would be really excited about adding that to my mix for my ramp up to, oh my God, I'm finally going to finish the whole friggin' series. And we sold out of Courtesan Prince and Righteous Anger yesterday. Good. At the Edge booth.
Thank you. One of the things Linda did when we first started coming to back to Worldcon, we were in Philadelphia at Millfield, and she gave us a story.
Angela's Wisdom.
Mm-hmm. It was written for Speculation. Was a group of magazines out at the time wanted stories on reluctant readers. How do you get them to read? You know, this type of stuff. And it was supposed to be written by a parent and a child. Well, the magazine didn't finish with the anthology, but we ended up with the story. It is still available. You can still get a copy of it. If I was doing my job right, it would be on a disc, and I always put it on the disc, and I give the disc away to everybody. You can write to me, all of you have my, and I will send you a copy of it. But it is kind of interesting because about science fiction introduced, we have an interview with Linda and her daughter, and then her daughter reads the story. It's one of the podcasts that they used to about science fiction. So stories have a way of coming around and keeping.
And Angela writing. Was a reluctant reader at that point.
Yes.
She's now a rabid fan of the Vlogbrothers, and she can be found on YouTube as Oklorel's daughter. She started blogging about the Oklorel series, and now she's sort of going over to the Vlogbrother side of things, but every now and then she pops back and does something, and she's become a very passionate reader, so it's an interesting life story. Mm. And just got a job as an optometrist, as a receptionist.
All right. I'm going to jump over to Lindy for a minute because we had a comment from back here.
Yeah, this is when you were talking about the Hunger Games and when to teach it. Mm. I teach it to my freshmen.
Right.
And I'm from a small town in Kansas, and one problem people have run into with the Hunger Games in our area, some parents, like sixth graders reading it, and some parents objected to it because it was kids killing kids.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's just one of those things that when they were saying, oh, like seventh or eighth grade, I even had some, or another woman I know had some seventh grade parents complaining about that. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes, too, depending on where you live or where you're teaching.
Oh, exactly. And that was an issue that did come up. And, of course, we kind of countered that with the whole Lord of the Flies thing. If you're going to teach Lord of the Flies to 14-year-olds, you could equally object that you have children killing children.
Yeah.
I'll
tell you on that. I have an issue with the fact that it seems like the recommended official literature for 5th and 6th grade, as well as middle school, it's almost all just terribly gruesome stuff. I mean, you want to win a Caldecott Award? Kill the kid's dog or his dad in the first chapter, and you're in. I really struggle when I'm choosing books for fifth and sixth grade, because I'm elementary, but fifth and sixth grade is where the kids are finally reading real books,
And it is a real struggle finding stuff that is well written, that's good, that has credibility in the eyes of the man, but isn't just an endless series of, oh God, my dad's in jail, and now my mom just broke her leg, and you know, come on.
Yeah. Let me piggyback off that. Middle grade and YA writing in general has trended darker and darker and darker mm-hmm. over the years. If you trace from the beginning of the Harry Potter series to the end of it, you almost see it happen in one series, right? And that reflects, there is the fact that that partly reflects a kind of maybe darkening outlook on the part of the target audience, you know, that they are growing up faster than they used to and see things differently than, let's say, we would have. But I agree strongly that one of the, I think it's almost a nervous tick in fantasy and especially science fiction, is a kind of desire to depress and a confusion of that with truth-telling. You know, how many apocalyptic tales have to be the stunning new vision of the future? There's nothing new about apocalypse, folks. Apocalypse has been done so many times, it's boring.
It's not the
really, I could,
story,
and I
pretty well,
pretty close.
It's
you know,
the
name
third
the
oldest story.
Sure. I, you know, I Am Legend and V for Vendetta, and I mean, you know, just zombie apocalypse is vampire. But
oh,
how many Resident Evil movies are we up to? You
I
know,
was the, talking about
the just,
Bible.
It's a staggering. That's good. Yes, yes, yes.
I was
yes.
thinking the same thing.
So there's a staggering amount of these tales out there, and I agree that it's become sort of a nervous tick among writers to write stuff of that kind. And one of the things that I try to do, because you know, the students that we get in our classrooms, again, this is about not, you know, putting your expectations on your students. The students we get in our classrooms, you've got to think about the shape of a quarter or a semester or whatever the length, or a year, or whatever length of time you're teaching, and make sure that you don't arrive in, if you're teaching for the full year, December and January, with a group of kids who have had the life beaten out of them by these, you know, one depressing tale after another. So
sure.
One of the things I think about is, so I lead off, as I said, I'll just use a science fiction example again. I lead off with, as I said, Frankenstein, Time Machine, Fahrenheit 451, not, you know, uplifting works by any means, but then we get to I, Robot, which is, in fact, a positive, optimistic book, despite the way it's misrepresented in that horrible movie. And then Star Trek, the old one, which also was optimistic and positive and suggested something different. That little breath in the middle of the semester is critically important because it gives students a chance to recover. It certainly has the same validity. No one's going to look at iRobot and say, what's that doing in a science fit? You know, it's legitimate in the eyes of the man. Same thing with the original, with the Star Trek series. So then we move on to, you know, Ender's Game and things like that, and we kind of go down a little bit again in terms of the tone. But that breath in the middle of the semester is critically important. Mm-hmm. In my fantasy course, I lead off with Beowulf and Grendel, bookended. It goes out of sequence chronologically, but it's too important to get Gardner's brilliant book in there along with Beowulf to really give them a sense of both works. And then we move on. Then we do Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And the reason that we do a young book like that is because, one, I'm teaching at the second largest Catholic university in the United States. So they've all read it at one point, you know, and they're going to get it again. But also because, again, it gives them that little bit, because Grendel is, as everyone knows, a dark book, and it gives them that little breath again before they move on to, you know, talk about the other books we're going to deal with during the course of the semester. So I think that moment of lightness is not only important in writing, and I think it's important for more science fiction writers to think about that before writing another everyone dies type of book, but it's also important in teaching, and we need to be conscious of that among students who are not going to all track as, you know, I want the darkest possible tale that you can give me, or to confuse that with seriousness and optimism with some kind of lighthearted fluffiness, which is not true.
So the other element that really bothers me about that, which is a bit of an ender, is if you confront young people with the message that the future is horrible and dark and gloomy, you can't trust anybody, life is like living on Big Brother House.
Right.
And the only way you can have some optimism or light is to go, okay, we're just going to worry about me and maybe one other person.
Right.
Which is where, you know, you'd go to when you are in those terribly dark places. Perhaps that's the best you can manage, and that's good if it's under the circumstances. But are we really living in a place that dark at the moment? And I think we're engendering a nihilism in young people as sort of a, you're going to be bounced as an idiot if you believe that there's anything good about human nature. In a time when we really, really need more people to have hope that
communally we can perhaps pull off, if not miracles, then at least a little bit of decency now and then.
I totally agree, including at a time, I have a 4.5-year-old myself, including at a time when what we need to be doing, when they're not as resilient as they will be when they get older with a different understanding and faith in the human condition, right? It's a mistake to think, well, I've got to tell them the truth right now, but that's not the truth. Or have we blown up yet? You know, it's not the whole truth, right? Well, it is an aspect of what's there, but there's also an aspect of positivism and nobility and heroism also. Mm-hmm. So avoiding one to the sake of the other, we also wouldn't want courses that are all Pollyannish, but I feel if you're looking at the lists, we have gone so far in the other direction that it's hard to sort of see, kind of look up above the ocean that you're drowning in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I've been told that my writing, that there's no heroes and no villains, that people are all a mixture of good and bad. Mm-hmm. And as I say, when I originally started it, the first book that ever came out was book 4 in the series, and it's got some very dark places in it, and I was working through things that alarmed and frightened me as an adult. So I was a little traumatized when I got young people reading it. But I've given up on that one because they tell me that, you know, they see plenty of worse things at night. And what my characters and my stories are doing are trying to help people figure out how do you deal with all this awful, evil stuff, mm-hmm. you know, what are the alternatives? And there was a young woman who's a friend of my daughter's, and it's not a terribly competent young woman in many ways. I mean, she's struggling in school, she has various issues, but she loved to read. She loved one of my characters. One day she was talking about some kind of dilemma, and she said, what would Daimon do? And I thought, okay, that's it. I'm really happy to have young people reading my books. I'm not going to squirm anymore about the personal discomfort about the sex and, you know, people making cracks at me. But, you know, that's worth a ton. I mean, if somebody in real life in a tight spot thinks about one of my characters and how they might cope with it, an imperfect character, who they also mock in anime, you know, then I've achieved something. You know, I mean, I needed heroes when I was growing up.
Well, actually, when you were speaking earlier, Linda, I made a note, because you mentioned in one sentence the words optimism and the words ethics. And it's something that I've been talking about in a lot of panels now for a couple of years and more, because I'm often in a situation where I'm defending genre writing. One of the things I say about genre writing is that, unlike, non-genre writing, we are able to celebrate the good in human beings, the honorable, the ethical, and we're allowed to do this without being ironic about it. Mm-hmm. Our people can actually do the right thing because it's the right thing. And that's what draws, mostly I write high fantasy. This is urban fantasy, but even though it has major elements, like, you know, somebody said to me, I don't usually read urban fantasy because there's no sword fighting in it. And I said, oh, there's plenty of sword fighting in mine, so, you know, not to worry about that. But one of the reasons that I was, that I still read science fiction and I still read fantasy, you know, having started at the age of 8, is that it is in our genre, and a little bit in the crime writing field, but not as much as it used to be, that we can actually mm-hmm. see people acting honorably. We can actually see role models, flawed though they may be. You know, they're not all great people. They're not all, you know, people we would want to have dinner with. But they are people that we can say to ourselves, what would that person do? Mm-hmm. You know, that we can use, even as adults, we can use as role models.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It is now 9:51, and gentlemen here, we're going to have a comment. Then I'm going to ask somebody to go back into Hunger Games and Little Brother and explain why they won the Hal Lemon Award. Okay. And I've got 50,000 notes, but go ahead.
Could you finish out your list of fantasy?
You didn't finish it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. So
the second part of that is where do you all find the distinction between science fiction and fantasy? And how do you treat them differently in your courses? I know for a lot of people who are not involved in the genre, it's all sort of the same thing. How did you get your courses separated up at some point?
Yeah. So I'll finish the list first. So Beowulf, Grendel, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Wizard of Earthsea, The Last Unicorn, And then there's a book that I'm missing in the middle, and I don't know why, because I haven't done my syllabus for the spring yet, obviously. I do Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book, which went over like gangbusters. And then the last book, I'm sorry, Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book, which is the first book ever to win a Newbery Award and a Hugo, which I think is an interesting kind of connection as well about the blurring of lines between YA and adult writing, leaving aside genre. And then the last book is the one that for a long time was very controversial for me personally, and it's that I teach my own work. I resisted that for a long time because I felt vaguely sleazy about it. You know, yes, professors teach their own textbooks all the time, but it felt odd to me, I don't know, that I was sort of establishing myself on this, and now to finish up, me, you know, which, and I felt like that wasn't, you know, that's not quite the way I'm trying to represent it, but my chairman actually prevailed on me and said, you're doing a disservice to your students if you don't do this, because, I remembered the other one, I'm sorry, The Alloy of Law was what I did in the spring, Brandon Sanderson's new Mistborn book, and that's because he was speaking to my class, so it worked out really well, and it's not a super long book either. Okay, so when I was teaching my own book, my chairman told me, you need to do this because your students want to be able to speak to an author directly. That it happens to be me is somewhat immaterial. What matters to them is that they have the opportunity to speak and actually have almost the process humanized for them, you know, so it's not just this magic on a page. That's certainly always been important in creative writing courses, where I think if you're not being published actively, I don't know what you're doing teaching a creative writing course. You know, this is supposed to be a working professional field, and you're supposed to be a working professional to do it. So, but in my fantasy, my literature course, I thought, well, you know, where am I sort of putting myself relative to them? He said it was important to do, and he was right. Every semester, the anonymous evaluations that I get at the end of the semester puts that as a highlight. Thank you for teaching your book. I learned so much from doing that. I think a few of them are hoping for the, now you will give me the answer, you know, because they've been asking, what does the author mean? You tell us what you mean. So there's a little bit of that. But mostly what they get from it, I think, is this, again, humanizing the process for them. So I have finished with my book, and that's helpful. As it turned out, it worked out really well for them. In answer to your question about separating fantasy and science fiction, these are obviously imperfect divisions. I would like to be able to teach, for example, Mark Hodder's book, The Strange Affair of Spring-Heeled Jack, which is a steampunk work. But it fits uneasily, as steampunk always has. Is it, you know, strictly fantasy? Is it science fiction a la Wells' Time Machine? It feels that way. It's set in the same era, right? Victorian England is generally what we're talking about with a lot of these. But you know, there are also these elements that don't feel science fiction-y but feel very magical and don't seem to have technology as much as they have some kind of sense of awe and wonder and mysticism about it, which isn't quite the same thing as what we would do with, like, hard SF.
Could you argue that it was alternate world?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah. You could do that. Okay. Sure. Right. Like, or an alternate history. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you should see what they do to Charles Darwin in that book.
Yeah, that's true.
But in any case, so what I've tried to do is, again, base it on the most seminal works of each. So, for example, Frankenstein is often considered the first science fiction book. I know there's some controversy about it, but it's a solid choice, right? Beowulf is also considered an opening to a lot of Western fantasy, and since it directly underpins fantasy that my students will be familiar with, like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, where the work is directly taken, you know, Smaug in The Hobbit, you know, gets mad because his golden cup has been stolen, and Beowulf, the dragon, stirs because his golden cup has been stolen, you know. Tolkien studied this stuff and was an expert in it, and so that's where he draws his inspiration. Well, given the impact that Tolkien had on so much epic fantasy and high fantasy, yeah, exactly, after that point, to avoid Beowulf is kind of, to me, educational malpractice. You know, I have to do that if I'm going to get that work in.
Can I just ask quickly, whose translation you use?
I use Seamus Heaney's. Mm-hmm. The reason is because it's by far, in my mind, the most interesting. Yeah. There's a reason that having poets translate, yeah, makes sense, I think. So
that's what I was hoping you were going to say.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
What about Artemis of Gaul? Because I just recently discovered that through Sue Burke's translation that she's in process with, and you know, that sort of underpins the whole knights in armor chivalry.
Sure, but I guess one of the things that I try to do is any time that I can make intersections with things that my students will already be directly familiar with, you know, in the Beowulf case, there was a albeit not very good, movie fairly recently. It is a constantly reoccurring trope. It allows me to get into the hero's journey. You know, all of these are things which are going to be things that I'll be coming back to again and again. And so that's a good one, too. But I think that this one ends up being, in my experience, has been a little bit more accessible. So the splitting of it basically is I try to do the best I can to look at very obviously seminal works. No one would accuse Beowulf of being science fiction, for example. And then kind of, you know, work from there. And if there are things that are close, like, for example, The Alloy of Law, which is kind of steampunk-y, I can even talk about that, about why do you think I made this part of this course and not my science fiction course in the fall. And we get into some interesting discussions about genre boundaries. The way that I managed to split it was simply by showing my university increasing enrollment. You know, I could show them, listen, I've been teaching this course for X number of years and this number of semesters, and now I'm teaching fantasy science fiction, that combo course that I used to teach, twice a year with increasing enrollment. So the numbers are there, and they said, okay, then you can split them. And now I'm trying to kind of strengthen that by making sure enrollment's good in each side. So, yeah.
I'll answer your question, too. I ripped this off from James Gunn. There's a speech he gave, a lecture he gave, which is titled Science Fiction, Its Present, Its Past, Its Future. And in that lecture, he starts by saying, you know, if we're going to talk about science fiction, let's talk about fantasy as well so we can differentiate the two. And he talks about science fiction as the literature of change. And then he talks about fantasy as the literature of difference so that we can split the two. Mm-hmm. He says science fiction is the literature of change because things have changed, because we have science at science fiction. In science fiction, there is some imaginative impact of science where, because of that science, you have a different world. We have cloning. We have genetic engineering. We have jetpacks. We have dinosaurs that have been, you know, Jurassic Park, something like that. So in that world, things are different because of the science. Yeah. In fantasy, we have the rules have changed. The rules are different. We have magic. We have the supernatural. We have unicorns. We have trolls. The rules in that world are just radically different. I really like that definition, and I give that to students at the beginning of the year. One of the first things I do with them is I draw a line on the whiteboard, and I separate the two, and I ask them, what is science fiction and what isn't science fiction? And it's interesting to see their answers, and we use that definition, the change and the difference, and they always have some interesting answers. They say, well, what about zombies? And we'll say, well, zombies can be science fiction if they come from a scientific plague or something like that. And they could be supernatural, and we'll put them in both columns. But it's always sort of important at the beginning to make sure that they understand the split. And then that we talk about those seminal early works like, well, Beowulf goes in this category, Frankenstein goes in this category, Frankenstein being that first work. Mm-hmm. But it's crucial that they see that split in the beginning so that as we continue to read throughout the semester, that they understand this is science fiction, this isn't science fiction.
So how it's defined is not as important as making sure everybody understands how.
Right, because as you said before, a lot of them think it's all the same.
Right.
And I think one of the disservices that's been done to the genre is when you go into the bookstore, it's all in the same
yep.
spot.
Right. Yep.
So everybody
yep.
gets confused and they think this is all the same. Yep. When I teach the course, I have them do 4 outside works over the course of the year that they have to read on their own, and they get them from wherever they can get them. So they'll go to the bookstore. They used to go to Borders before it closed, and they will bring whatever they can find, and half of the time they would bring a fantasy work because it's all in the same spot. Yeah. And I'll tell them you can't read that.
Well, so. I have my own readers and people who have very evidently read my work, not just a work of fantasy, that say, oh, it must be great to be a science fiction writer. And I've just gone, thank you.
Yeah.
It's a compliment.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
If I could offer another alternate definition, back in Los Angeles County, I'm hiking buddies with Larry Niven, and we talk a lot about stories and all kinds of things while we're hiking. And his definition, for what it's worth, between science fiction and fantasy is, just as an fairly arbitrary rule, is in science fiction you get 3 what-ifs. You know, what if you had faster-than-light travel? What if you had, you know, what if you had clean fusion? What if you had, you know, you get to a point where, in his opinion, if you're asking more than 3 big what-ifs in your story, then you're writing fantasy. So there's a lot of book that they're, you know, just because it's in the future and they're on spaceships, his opinion is that's not enough to make it science fiction. So for example, Star Trek he considers fantasy because there are just so many what ifs. That doesn't mean it's not good, of course. But his thing is he's really into hard sci-fi, and he'll postulate a couple of major what ifs in a story, but he limits himself to 3 what ifs. Plus the corollaries that come out of those things.
Okay. Normally, if we were in a regular type panel, we've gone over. Thank goodness we still have time left. I will get to you in just a second, but I'm going to interrupt for a commercial. Okay. And the reason I'm doing that is because we were talking of Hunger Games, and now I'm going to add a little brother into it, and she will defend or explain why they tied as co-equals for the Hal Clement Award for excellence in children's science fiction. Okay.
In 1991, I was children's programming here at Chi-Town, and I tried to talk them into getting a young adult Hugo. Couldn't do it. And yesterday at the business meeting, Chris Barkley tried again. He still couldn't do it. Although the vote was 51 to 67. So basically, the convention that I became part of, which is DuPageCounty.com, said, let's start our own science fiction award. And because I've taught K-12, we decided to have three awards, picture book, middle grades, and young adult. And you said something about a window for Orson Scott Card's book. I kind of disagree with that because sometimes that window can be fuzzed. I was 34 years old expecting my first child when I read it, and I said, wow.
But that was your window. The window was open for you at that moment.
Okay, see, well, I mean, I'm, rather than a certain age.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I
said, opens later than that, too, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, this book is wonderful. And the year that we had both Hunger Games, and little brother was like, wow, they're both wonderful, but this is a female character and this is a male character. Both showed tremendous growth as people. And the committee finally decided we had to do both. They were equally good. And we figured this was also a way because some people will only want to read girl characters and some people will only want to read male characters. Females tend to be more likely to read a male character's point of view. And but I have to admit, Hunger Games has probably as many male readers as it does female. Mm-hmm. It speaks very well to both. And so we saw no other way of doing it other than having a split award that year. And the big reason for doing a children's and young adult science fiction award is that librarians and schools with limited funds tend to only buy books that have awards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there, if you look through the Caldecott and Newbery list, very few science fiction. Lots of fantasy, mm-hmm. but very few science fiction.
Will you tell me again the name of the award, please?
The Golden Duck Award.
That's the Golden Duck. Okay.
For the middle grade, for the young adult one, we named it after Hal Clement as a way of honoring a man who put his heart and soul into bringing young people into the field.
Hmm. You have a list of this year's winners in the...
In here? Cool.
Yeah. And if I could just... Cory Doctorow is coming to this area on October 9th. Little Brother is the community reading book for 60015, which is Deerfield Bannockburn Riverwoods. And Doctorow will be speaking on the night.
Wonderful.
How are they
He's
doing?
Great man.
Sorry?
The students, did they like it?
We just started.
Again,
and,
we started.
And what I love about Cory is he's willing to give his book for free.
He's yeah. just downloaded it. It's marvelous. And so far, so good.
Cool. He's coming out with a sequel now.
Yeah.
So. Right. But he does give it away free. Yes.
May I just since we're running out of time.
We're never running out of time. We're just running out of time
for this panel. Yeah. Well, that's actually my question is, now my focus on science fiction as a general ed teacher, I don't really have the luxury of focusing on it as literature very much. But however, I am a math and science specialist at the elementary level. And so, I'm wondering, is anybody interested in discussing maybe in a separate panel sometime using science fiction to actually teach science?
Mm.
It's used quite a bit.
Julie certainly.
Yeah, because I do it.
Perfect for that.
Yeah, Julie is.
Julie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She cool. has a series called Wonder. What is it? They're out. They're basically out of print. You have one of the pages from one of her teacher manuals. Mm-hmm. She only came out with one teacher manual for her Worlds of Wonder.
Right. She went and selected science fiction parts of text and special short stories just to teach science concepts.
Sure.
And what she did is she went out to various authors. She had them write the story. Then she had a teacher write the questions and some of how you could use it in your classroom.
Sure.
Great, great.
Yeah.
And she also should have been in charge of doing things in PhilCon, but somehow I ended up by doing it.
All right.
And I've never forgiven her.
Yeah, so. just one thought I'd like to contribute on that note is that I find the badly done science in television and movies can be a terrific basis for science lessons too, because you know,
oh, yeah.
in fact, kids from fifth grade to eighth grade love nothing better than you know saying that demonstrating that grown-ups are getting it wrong. And
no
so
explosions in space.
Yeah, exactly. So you like watch an old episode of Star Trek and enjoy it, you know, and then say, okay, now let's just pick it apart. You know, let's find 10 things they got completely wrong.
One caveat. That's totally agree. That's 100% true. I remember at last Worldcon watching and it may have been, I don't know if it was an About SF panel or not, but where there were a group of scientists speaking to a group of all of you, people who are interested in education at either the elementary or secondary, post-secondary level. And what they got to see, and I know because I watched some of it, were these scientists arguing with each other over who had a better grasp on science in their work. If you want to watch people shut down any faster than these folks did listening to a bunch of people yell at each other about how many corks could dance on the head of a pin, you'd have a hard time finding it. It was funny, but it was intensely frustrating to me, because what you're doing is ensuring that those people are going to say, well, I'm not going to teach science fiction in my courses if this is the reaction that I'm going to get. Please do not forget about the human elements that lie at the basis of fantasy and science fiction and about which we are most interested, which is not at all, you're totally right. I don't in any way mean that to be against what you said. You're 100% right.
You're right. Yeah, it isn't primarily about science, because it is science. And it's also literature.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And literature is ultimately about human experience. So yeah. I just want to be clear that we're clear about that point, because, oh my heavens, if I had tried to bring that to my students and said, you know, let's talk about this, I mean, I would have them running for the doors. So
yeah.
I want to make sure that we're clear about that. This is about the human experience. And part of the reason, I think, that these books were talking about, for example, Ender's Game, that I said I wasn't that wild about, they liked it largely because they identified with the humanity of Ender.
Yeah,
yes, the battle game is cool. Yes,
yeah.
this other stuff
yeah,
is cool.
Exactly.
But what they really liked was I felt bad for Ender. I think that's enormously instructive and much more important than how many NASA theories we can bandy about. So I just, you know,
yeah.
one, you're totally right, but just one little caveat, you know, about that.
Yeah.
No, you are right. You know,
if you were teaching physics, it would be worth looking at Ender's
Game. Of course.
No,
yeah, sure, sure.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you can use hard science fiction to teach science literacy. Which is done, I'm sure, in physics courses and things like that. But for our purposes, anyway, yours and mine, it's that idea of teaching humanity, teaching the human condition, using it as a sociological study of society,
right.
Showing this is what we are at our worst. It's something like Frankenstein.
Sure.
Showing this
or
is the
Hunger
compassion.
Games.
Or Hunger Games,
yeah.
yeah.
You know.
This is the compassion that's comparable to humanity in Ender's Game.
Yeah.
And there are all these different aspects that you can use, but it's the study of literature at the same time.
So. Yeah, which...
I wanted to ask you guys one thing. We are running out of time, because you...
No, we're not running out of time. We've got 10 minutes.
Okay.
You were kind enough to give us your syllabus. And the thing I wanted to ask about is the only science fiction course that's being taught at Queen's University in Kingston at the moment has Brave New World. Do I need to go on? I think you see where I was. 1984. Okay, I think fairly recently, and obviously had to be fairly recently, Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale.
Okay. Oh, God.
Wow. Yes, exactly. And this is what they're still teaching
yes.
there.
Yeah.
And that's, it's like, okay, it has to be, you know, 40 or 50 years, oh, except for for the sainted Margaret Atwood. I mean, she's Canadian, after all.
Yes.
So, you know,
yeah.
That, she gets under the wire that way. You know, basically what they're doing is they're teaching only what they can safely claim to be the classics.
High literature.
You know, you guys, yeah. The Time Machine was mentioned, you know, War of the Worlds was mentioned. But, you know, one of the things that strikes me, again, in context of the conversation we were having a few minutes ago, is that these are all dystopias.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it seems to be acceptable to teach, at least at Queen's University, you know, it seems to be acceptable to teach science fiction as long as it's, you know...
As long as nobody's enjoying it.
And nobody's
right.
Thank you.
As long as everyone feels really bad about themselves when they leave.
Yeah.
As long
as, you know. Exactly. And, you know, like, one of the things that I'd be really interested in finding out is, how did you guys get out of that? You know, what I think of as the dismal ghetto.
Yeah, the dismal ghetto.
Well, I mean, this goes back a little bit to what we were talking about before, about this confusion between science fiction and the seriousness of science fiction and the optimism or, depressive qual or pessimism of science fiction. One of the advantages that I have in my courses, and it's an advantage that not everybody shares, especially if you're teaching at the secondary level or the secondary level or the elementary level, is that you have some limitation as to what texts you're allowed to teach. Mm-hmm. I do not have that problem. I can teach what I want, when I want, thank heavens. And it's one of the reasons I have to say that I ultimately left high school teaching. It was never about, you know, the students that I taught, who I always have enjoyed. I mean, that's never varied, regardless of what level or, you know, what position I was doing it in. But the content was an issue, so I didn't have to deal with that. That said, even without someone telling me, you know, you must teach this, that, and the other, I think what you're talking about is a sort of general kind of assumption about what counts as being appropriate science fiction. And I guess the only thing I can say in answer to that is that I tried to think of, again, the shape of the semester, and I tried to think about sort of taking these little breaths of optimism while still maintaining the, this sort of seminal work. And it's fortunate that roughly in the chronological middle I get things like the old Star Trek or iRobot, which are more optimistic works, and in fact, in the iRobot case, being able to show them, you know, little clips from this terrible movie, which is not iRobot, which is in fact the opposite of iRobot, and then showing them, you know, the actual book, is enormously helpful, because you have something that literally took Asimov's message and inverted it out of this misguided belief that would make it more serious. But it's nonsense.
For the folks out here dealing with Common Core, that hits several Common Core standards right there.
Yeah.
So if you want to make that Common Core, iRobot and text, iRobot to movie. You've got, I can think of three off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That immediately hit your Common Core standards.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
The unfortunate things is they never used the first script.
By Harlan Ellison, sure. Yeah.
The one that Asimov had approved.
Yeah, sure.
They went completely under.
But I'll say this, though, that I still, you know, get a smile on my face, and I get them all the time when I get emails from students who say, you know, Dr. Wilson, I saw the movie, and you're right, this has nothing to do with the book. I said, yes, go forth and explain, you know, at least tell them. And again, that's sort of, so I guess thinking about the shape of the semester and trying to put those little breaths of optimism in the middle is important, too.
I'll answer your question as well, and I have actually been really fortunate, too, at the senior level to sort of been able to redesign the course in the vision that I wanted. I've been able to pick the books that I wanted to teach. There's been a little bit of pushback on some of them from sort of counseling office administration, not much, but I've pretty much been able to do what I wanted, and that's how I came up with the list that I have. Our only sort of requirement has been financial. You know, do we have the money to buy the books? Because we as a public school have to be able to offer the books to those kids. The college level, you would just say, you guys got to buy these books.
Though I try to keep the prices low, but you're right.
Which is great. What's interesting is I also teach the AP literature class. And in that class, I get away with teaching The Handmaid's Tale, which you brought up, and Frankenstein. And, you know, I could also teach Brave New World. I could also teach 1984. And the only reason I could teach those four titles is because those titles have shown up on the AP exam at the end of the year. And it's funny because it's those titles that the world sort of acknowledges as high literature. They don't really look at them as science fiction. They look at them as literature.
Which is why I think that the professors at Queen's are not.
That's why they're on that list.
It's not that they're being, it's not that they have someone to answer to in that sense.
Right.
It's they're choosing this because they feel, well, these are works of literature, therefore we can teach them. You know, as a general rule, these are the exceptions.
Right.
You know, the rest of it's not literature.
The rest of it's garbage.
Only, yeah, the rest
yeah.
of it's garbage.
Well,
yeah,
one, we'll find the others.
One yeah. quick point about yeah. that, as everybody knows, Margaret Atwood famously denies
yeah,
that she writes science fiction.
Science fiction, right.
And I don't know if anyone has seen Ursula Le Guin's review of Oryx and Crake, where Ursula Le Guin starts out by saying, I'm paraphrasing, it is unfortunate that I cannot use the language of science fiction and fantasy to review this text because Margaret Atwood tells me I'm not allowed to. And then goes on to, you know, sort of deconstruct that work in a brilliant way because obviously, for obvious reasons, take Ursula Le Guin seriously. And what that points out is the sheer ridiculousness of avoiding some kind of genre tag. Mm-hmm. Does anyone really believe that Margaret Atwood's going to have trouble selling books if she admits she teaches science fiction?
Precisely.
So I think, in a way, the authors themselves sometimes contribute to that. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, apparently, in more recent times, Linda, you may be able to back me up on this, she has said, oh, well, in a somewhat grudging fashion, well, yeah, I guess it really is science fiction. But I think it's because, you know, public pressure has and you know, people have said to her basically, why are you ashamed of your work?
Right.
So
That's one Magic Castle problem. I've noticed that.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody wants to be the cool kid.
Yeah.
And if your definition of the cool kid when you go to cocktail parties involves dissing genre literature,
then you
don't want to be but if cool to you means that you make money by publishing, then you diss literary stuff. And because it's all make-believe anyway, it's not like you can go, okay, I built that bridge and you didn't. It's all a case of debate. It's all fiction.
It's
a Magic Castle problem.
Well, you know, I like to think of things more as, you know, was it well written, you know, as opposed to was it badly written? And that, for me, are the big distinctions.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, as an 18th century scholar, I go back far enough where, you know, the two genres were prose and poetry. So, you know, to me, anything after that, it's like, oh, we're being too fussy. We're being too picky now.
Technically, we're out of time, but there's a comment here. We have the next panel is showing up here. We're going to keep going until we're kicked out.
I like to think you saved the best for last, but in addition to being a member of CIFLA, I'm also on the board of directors of the National Space Society. And it's always been very depressing to me to watch science fiction change from the language of hope and aspiration, which actually built the space age, into the dystopian world of science fiction and fantasy, which people have regressed into. But what I wanted to contribute is a number of years ago, I had the privilege of writing the science fiction book list for the Reading Group Handbook. And this was designed to be a book list introduced people who really don't read science fiction from their 20s to wherever up to science fiction. And what I was looking for were things that, along with development of character and drama, they're characteristically as an idea or a series of extraordinarily thought-provoking ideas that makes readers sit back and reevaluate the way they relate to their own culture and world. And the way I described this collective list was the following stories, almost all of them classics in the field, which, by the way, these are still very valid. And constantly reprinted, range widely from the intensely personal to the universally significant, from humorous to somber. And for reading, they range from merely engrossing to riveting. And, you know, you can't teach all these books, but make a wonderful supplemental reading list for kids in school who just grab onto stuff in their spare time.
Yeah,
if anybody wants to see this, or...
is there a place we can get it online?
No, I'll give you my email address, and I'll send it to you. jgl@aol.com.
JGL@aol.com.
Okay.
Thank you. And your name, sir?
Jeffrey Liss.
Jeffrey Liss.
We do have a comment from the back. He's telling us it's time to get out of here.
Yeah. Thank you all. Thanks.
Before you leave.